No, then, mate. You all right?
Yeah, good, you?
Yeah, not bad.
Been busy doing all of these?
No, I've been hammering them a bit recently.
Tonight, it's been good. Been obviously looking back and listening to... You forget some of the stuff yourself. It's not until you hear a little reminder of... I listened to Colin Young's. I was in that lift that he was on about when Simon Dakin fell out that lift.
Oh, really? Yeah. What's the story there, then?
Do you know what? It was probably all more innocent than it actually sounds. We'd been out the night before, but there was like a Club 1830 meeting the next day. They tried to get us to this meeting, the rep. So we all got in, and then there was maybe six of us in the lift. Should have been four of us, six of us in the lift. The lift stopped between floors. We was in there for about 20 minutes, and do you know, you start to get a bit, we need to get out, really. It starts to panic a bit more. And then they open the lift shaft doors, and you could see the brick wall in front of you and a gap at the bottom. So obviously I've gone out first, and there's a guy stood on the next floor. And as you jump out, he grabs you and pulls you forward. Size jumped out, and as the guys grabbed him, he fell back, but fell back down under the lift shaft and just plummeted down the lift shaft. But, you know, you got to the bottom, he was covered in blood and rubble. It was a mess. You know, he thought it was... Manny got there first, was white as a ghost, thought he was dead. It was a real... You know, considering we'd only just got on the... We'd only been there one night, and mate was almost... We thought he was dead at one point, but he come back, you know, punctured lung, broke his leg, and it was a bit of a mess. But it wasn't necessarily he was doing something stupid. It was half past eight in the morning. We got stuck in the lift. The engineer told us to jump out that way, which probably, in hindsight, wasn't the best thing to do. But we all did. He was a lift engineer, and that's how it went.
Bloody hell. How many floors was that then? Did you say four?
I think it was more than that. I think it was five or six floors. But apparently they have all the chains that connect the lift, so I think that broke his fall. So the chains have nicked his body, which made him bleed heavily, but they said it stopped it being a straight six-floor plunge, which you wouldn't have had much chance for.
What stage of that was a holiday, then?
First day. We got to Tenerife about 10 o'clock at night, when we'd been drinking, obviously, during the day in the plane, like you do. Went out on the night, got in probably 4 in the morning, half 8 in the morning, the rep's banging on the door, come to the reception meeting. We didn't really want to go. We all... did, and then that was that. So yeah, we'd been on the island less than 24 hours. We was having to ring the manager, ring the media, you know, Colin Young, especially, I think Manny spoke to him. I had to ring Simon's parents and all of that. It was a bit of a mess.
So is it Terry Dillon at the time that's manager?
Yeah, Terry was manager at the time. It was as Colin said, it was a front page story. Obviously, it was all there. It was a front page story. Do you know, I think we was keen to sort of stress it. On the face of it, six lads all going away and someone falls down the lift. It sounds like you're doing something you shouldn't. I'm not necessarily sure we did that much wrong. It was just a, you know, set of circumstances that sort of happened that way. It wasn't as if anyone was doing anything they shouldn't have been. We was in the lift. It stopped. They told us to get out. We did, and he fell back down through it.
How long was he stuck over there then?
Because he'd punctured his lung, he couldn't fly back. So he ended up being out there for maybe... 3 or 4 weeks extra than us until they could sort his lungs out, so he would be able to be fine with a flight home. But we used to have it. It was sort of like, it was, you know, he's only 19. You just weren't prepared for anything like that. So it ended up being me and Rob Dewhurst used to visit him in the morning. Manny and Hobbo used to visit him in the afternoon. And then we'd all go out on the night. That was our holiday.
Good memories.
it was bizarre.
But he played again, didn't he? So he was all right in the end.
Do you know what? Randomly, and I cannot sort of understand why. I mean, he ended up, he played again, but he maybe only played a couple of games before he got released. And in theory, then he went to play semi-pro. I mean, he'd have probably got a bigger payout from the company, who obviously they admitted liability in the end. He went to court and he got a payout. If he'd have not played again, he'd have probably got a miles bigger settlement than he did, but clearly he was desperate to, he still wanted to try and play again and still carry on in the game. I think he's done quite well, Si. I think I think he's a lawyer involved in business takeovers and businesses and things like that. So I think, yeah, he's probably better out the game than he was in.
Yeah, Adam, so if we go right back like we always do, what are your first memories of Boothroyd Park?
Best memories of Boothroyd Park, I think, for me, obviously, a Hull lad will be being a fan. I think my dad's from a rugby league background, so he didn't really have much interest in football at that time. So I used to go with my uncle and my cousin. So around them times, you know, they used to pick me up, take me to the games, mid-80s probably. I think one of my earliest memories of it was then as you get a little bit older, I just went with my cousin. So I think he, at the time, I'd have been maybe 10 or 11. He would have been about 15, would have been the, I think it was a York game where they got promotion around 85, I think. Everybody ran on the pitch at the end, as you do, and all of a sudden I'm 10 or 11, ran on my cousin, next thing turned around, couldn't find him in the days before mobiles or anything else, and just sort of lost, wandering around the pitch with everybody else and trying to get back to the meeting point, which was B&Q car park. I used to park in there, so just wandering around there. But yeah, that was it was a good game because it was I think they got beat, but it promotion, pitch invasion, 11 years old, lost my cousin, just everything about it. Just, and I think that's for me, looking back as a fan of football, because I didn't necessarily go with my dad. It was either when I went to Hull City, I said I went with my cousin who was a little bit older than me. You give that freedom. There was times when I went to some of the games as finish school, get the bus with your mates. It just felt a little bit, I guess the atmosphere sometimes is a bit dangerous as well, but it was just part of growing up as a youngster going to them games. I think when you played for Hull City Boys, you got a schoolboy pass, so you could go in the well after games, so travel away in the morning, go on the well. So most of my football is spent as a fan going with friends, and I thought that was fantastic. So that's my memories of it as a as a supporter. As a player, signed schoolboy forms at 14, used to train in the gym, Boothroyd Park gym, twice a week, and then you get offered a YTS at 16 and leave school and go there. But I think the best thing about Hull City in them days, and it's a totally different structure to the one they have now with academies and everything, they used to have Hull City Miners, as it was called, run by Mike Rawdon, who, you know, sadly no longer with us. But they used to play in the county league. So they're just playing like the Saturday afternoon local football league. And at that point, it was made up of players who were not getting a game in the juniors, players who were probably under 16 and in the last year at school. But the club would also play young pros who they felt needed an extra game, but you could play any professional you wanted to play. So it's sort of unheard of now, but brilliant memories. I remember they used to just ring my dad up and say you're needed or you're not needed, depending on who else was available. So you get the call and say you're needed, we've got a game in the county league, and you never knew who was playing. And you'd get to the changing room, and all of a sudden, I remember one game particularly where Gareth Roberts was coming back from injury, and he's club captain at the time, and you walk in the changing room and Gareth's there, I'm playing right back and he's playing right midfield. And you know, you think about it, you're in your last year at school and suddenly you're turning out with the club captain when you're a fan was an absolutely brilliant thing. And then, you know, really, I think to try and explain that to people who are used to the modern structure, it is unheard of. I guess there's something to be said for the, you know, promising young players going all over the East Riding and getting kicked about by some of the teams used to play. It wasn't all positive, hence why they changed it. But it did have some great benefits for it, playing for the Miners, and then the Watcher playing for them and offer you a YTS. And my route, probably 2 years YTS, brilliant days. And then they pull three of us into the room and say, we're going to offer you a professional contract. And I can still remember that now, because that's the first time, you know, since you've been little, you wanted to be a professional footballer. And when Terry Dolan says you're going to be a professional player, all three of us got the same contract, £90 a week, which we was certainly not thinking of retiring on after one season. But it was, you was a professional with Hull City, and that was amazing.
Yeah. Just going back to your YT days, because I saw you posted a picture on Facebook of you cleaning the baths, is it? Was that your job?
So I was a home team bathroom. So obviously we, things like the stands, everybody did the stands after games, or you know, the glamorous jobs of getting the bird muck off the best stand seats on a Friday before the games on a Saturday. All them jobs everybody mucked in with, but everybody had their own job, whether it be boots or cleaning home and away bathrooms. So yeah, mine was the home team bathroom, which basically meant after training every day, I used to have to make sure that the bathroom was as it should be and stocked up with everything it needs to be. And also my job was probably around 20 minutes before, because that's how long you fill up, about 20 minutes before the end of games, first team and reserves, used to nip in, get the bath running, make sure the temperature was right. So once the game finished, they'd all nip in the big bath.
Hobbo was saying he had quite a cushy job doing the kits. Was your job a bit more hands-on than that, do you think?
Yeah, I think the kits always came with a little bit probably more responsibility of you having to get everything right. Mine was, it wasn't necessarily the most difficult job in the world, keeping on top of it or everything. But yeah, kitman was probably a bit more of a cushy job. Home team bathroom. Yeah, there was some interesting characters. I think some of the hardest things were you used to be under a little bit of pressure where you couldn't go home unless all the jobs were done. So generally, home team bathroom was one of the jobs that was probably the last one because you needed everyone out of the bath. And B, you know, if someone had a bad game and they sat sulking in the bath, you're not necessarily going to go, any chance of getting out? Because we all want to get away. And so everybody's waiting for you saying, come on, tell him to get out. And you think, no way, at 16 and 17, was you telling experienced pros to hurry up when they're sat sulking in the bath?
Yeah, yeah. Was that like Billy Whitehurst era kind of thing?
Yeah, Billy had been gone then. I think when I first sort of, Peter Swan and Andy Payton were there. And one particularly, I remember Dave Jones, who played up front, remember him. I think he'd had a little bit of a bad time. He was set in the bath for a long time. Yeah, and it was difficult because, you know, people, it mattered to people. There weren't necessarily great times. And yeah, it was, you know, it's almost a place to sit and reflect the idea of the big bath. I think there was other times where there were good results and you can hear the lads singing and the atmosphere in the, it was a unique experience.
When it comes to making a debut, yeah. I was looking at it today, it's just funny because your first game was my first game I ever went to.
Was it?
The Bradford game. And I always remember, I look back at the programme when I'm back at my mum's and that, and in the centre is like you and Ozzy in the sponsors
bit. Yeah. And, is that in that same programme?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I would have been listed on the team sheet or anything then, because I would have been still been. Obviously, just, well, I was 18 in the August, and I think it was from the 3rd of October from memory or something like that. So, yeah, just literally turned 18. I think it was what Brian Mitchell was fullback at the time, and he was injured, and he'd been injured. But initially how it happened is Terry put the reserve team sheet up in the dressing room, as he always does for the Wednesday, and I'm not included in it. And my first thought was I'd been dropped from the reserves. And I remember going out to train on the back pitch, really almost like heartbroken, just 18, thinking, what have I done wrong? I'm not in the reserves tonight. Didn't even give it any thought. And he pulls me in training to say, look, Brian Mitchell's not going to be fit for the weekend and you're going to play. And it almost took a couple of seconds to actually realise what he meant, and that he meant you're going to play for the first team. So I found out probably, you know, Wednesday. He said, as far as the media are concerned, we're not going to say anything. We're going to say that we think Brian's got a chance and we're going to leave it late. But I want to tell you now to give you the best chance to prepare for it. And I guess in that it was, obviously all the rest of it is a little bit of a blur, but it was quite a big game at that time. You know, I think we were third, they were top, we beat them. There was 10,000 there. It was a, you know, good Yorkshire derby atmosphere. And so Dean, we went 1-0 up after about 30 seconds. Dean got sent off after 10 minutes. They equalised and we went on to win 3-1. So as debuts go, it was quite a memorable debut. There was a lot of things happening. It was a big game. And I think it was one of my, it's no exaggeration, so it changed my life in a way, not in any other way, but I knew after that game nobody could ever take that away from you. You'd been a young lad from Hull, going to watch, always wanted to play for Hull City. And once that game, it was almost like, I've played for Hull City. And I almost felt that, and I still feel that now, is, you know, whoever in your conversation with, nobody can ever take that away from you. And I'm as proud now as I was back in the day when it happened.
Yeah, it's interesting you say let you know a few days before, because I think both Hobber and Willow said they found out last minute. Do you think it was better or worse that you found out a few days before?
I'm not sure, really. I think either one could have had the pros and cons. I must admit, there was, you know, from a nerves point of view, you did have a lot of time to actually to be nervous and think about it. And again, as a local lad, you was limited to who you actually told you was going to play, so they could come and watch. But that, from that point of view, I was able to tell people, and people who were probably close to me were at the game to be able to watch it, which maybe wouldn't have happened if it had just been a bit of a left field call out the blue. So I had probably had a couple of days to actually get used to the idea that I would be playing. But yeah, there were times then where I don't think there was any minute of any day where you wasn't thinking about what was going to happen on the Saturday.
And then in terms of, you know, we're doing quite well at that point in the season. Do you think that makes it, I guess there's pros and cons again to it, but do you think that makes it a bit easier for you to slot in?
Yeah, do you know what? I think it was it was a good side. Then I ended up, so I literally just turned 18, so he came into the side and had a good game, well, a decent game against them. I think we went Port Vale away and got beat in the last, virtually last kick of the game, got beat 2-1. I think Port Vale was up there with us as well around that time. And then we drew 1-1 with Fulham at home, which was Rich Peacock's first game. And then I think Brian Mitchell came back. I played a few games in the reserves, and I don't think I was brilliant when he got back to the reserves. I think it was just, I think that was probably everything that had happened over the last few weeks just catches up. And I played a couple of games that were not necessarily the best. And I think then when Brian got injured again, David Norton played at right back. So they'd moved someone else into midfield and Norton played at right back. And so I didn't necessarily play much for the rest of that season, a couple of games off the bench perhaps or in the squad. But as a young lad coming in then, you felt you had opportunities, because I know obviously you've had the guys on, but year above me, Neil Allison and Steve Wilson, and then you've got, you know, Gary Hobson and Graham Atkinson. So it always felt that there was a pathway into the team for local lads. But around that time, I think you had, which maybe not towards the back end of when I was there, you had good local lads, young lads, along with good experienced pros, good solid, you know, like Mally Shotton, Dave Hockaday, Dave Norton, David Mayle, and then along the lads of Dino, but really, really good experienced pros who were big characters and good in the dressing room.
Just wanted to mention Ozzy, really, going back to Ozzy.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, we lived on the same street, so he was... You know, he was the big character on there with his shop and everything. Where did your relationship start with him?
Well, I think with Ozzy, obviously he moved in with the area. I remember going to a big character, because he owned the local news agents, and so if you own the local news agents, you know everybody in and around the area. So we obviously going in the shop, got to know everybody, and you know his kids are not dissimilar age to me. So I think you see that from just going to the schools and everything. Knew he was obviously a big Hull City fan, and then whenever I would go in, as I even when I started playing, would have that thing. And you know, he when they asked for sponsorship, he came forward and he used to sponsor me. So I was always sponsored by Endike News, got to know him, you know, and the family really well. Just again, larger than life character, always happy to see you, you know, and some real good memories. I remember, I think it was Andy who was speaking at obviously at his dad's funeral, at Ozzy's funeral, about the times of going away to the matches with his dad and what a special time there was. Where I used to get him tickets for the away games, so they'd get the complimentary tickets and go there. And I think one of the best ones with Ozzy was around, obviously because he used to sponsor us, he'd said to me, you didn't have to go through the club or anything. So he just said to me one time, you know, we were going to, I think it's Hancock's, the wholesalers, where local news agents would get their supplies from, and he said they're having an opening and they want to do a bit of a raffle, and they've asked if I can get a couple of Hull City players there. So I said, yeah, no problem, Ozzy. And he'd asked Alan Fettis as well, who we knew quite well at that time. So me and Alan went with Ozzy. We went to, I think he was Hancock. So we went there to the big sweet place anyway. There was a bit of a raffle all day, all the news agents coming in, get sorted out. And at the end of the day, the guy from Hancock's, he'd give us like an empty shopping trolley, me and Fettis, and said, "You can have anything you want. Thanks for today, lads." So you can imagine, like, I think it was maybe 19, 20. You've got an empty shopping trolley and you've just got carte blanche to go round an entire sweet shop and put as much as you want in. I still remember it. It was absolutely brilliant. We had, you know, cola cubes and everything like that. It was brilliant. And a supply that lasted us for ages.
Love to see a photo of that.
yeah, he was good. Yeah, but brilliant character, was he? One of them people who, you know, known by a lot of people and loved by lots of people.
Yeah, I mean, when I think of, you know, City, especially in the 90s, you know, he was the epitome of it, really.
Yeah.
Real positive, yeah. City fan, real massive, well, City fan.
And you know what, again, because he sponsors me and he gets to know a lot of the players, and a popular guy, and it must be really difficult, when I've seen it with a different one, is when you get people who can mix with the players as well. He was a fan and he was forthright, but he was also respected by the players. He knew what the line was, as in he was never abusive. He spent money going, staying in hotels, staying overnight, watching games. A massive fan and really disappointed, but never, ever let that, it never came. He just wasn't like that as a character, and he would speak to all the players and be popular.
Yeah, yeah. I remember we saw him once on the train to London. I think we were just going for a trip away, and he was going all the way to watch to watch Fettis play for York.
Yeah, yeah.
Just like amazing attitude.
Yeah, just absolutely loved it. And like you said, special time. I think that's whether you're a player or a fan at any particular period, I guess some of your memories are not necessarily related to success on the pitch as well. You just had a brilliant, you know, if that's a period of your life where you go with your friends or you go with your dad and you reflect back, whatever it is, you can reflect back on those periods with absolutely fond memories, regardless of what is happening on the pitch to a certain extent. I don't know, when I look back now, it's not the most successful period of the club's history, but I look back with some of the characters you met and some of the things and absolutely loved it. And I think that's true for a lot of people.
Is it 94, 95 when you start playing a bit more, you start being a bit more of a regular?
Yeah, I think it was sort of, I think the 94, 95 season, the first game was probably, I think it was Oxford away where they got beat 4-0. And then I think I played in the League Cup game and then had a bit of a run of 9, 10, 11 games in that season, which I think that was one of them was the crew game where we won 7-1 and different ones like that. So we started off and did quite well and was there or thereabouts in the sort of pushing towards playoffs, which was reasonable with quite a limited size squad that we had.
Yeah. And then obviously we've mentioned it a lot on the on here, but you played in the end of the season game when Fettis scored, and it sounds like a bit of a mad day really.
Yeah, do you know what? I think it was down to the bare bones. So I think it was a great day because you knew the two things. It was absolutely red hot. I don't think I've come off the pitch and literally nose and cheeks were glowing. I think it was, you know, that type of day. Everybody went. So we had maybe 7 or 8 lads, Hobo included, injured lads, who literally, you got there at 12 o'clock. And while we all went for a pre-match meal, they've all disappeared to the local pub, had a few beers and everything else. Last game of the season, nothing really to play for, other than, you know, just the pride as normal, I think. And Fett starts up front. I don't think he had the greatest game ever, but he ended up scoring a last minute winner. They've all had a few. Everybody's back out on the night. It was just a good end of season trip. And I think same for the fans as well. I know a few people who have spoke to have been there. Said glorious day, crossed to Blackpool, watched the team win. An iconic goal from Fettis, who was a popular kid, and a good day all round.
Must have been a good night out after the crew game as well, 7-1. You played in that, didn't you?
Yeah. The crew game was good. Do you know what I remember? I think the crew game was maybe only 2-1 at half time, something like that, and they was well in it. And then you had a series of, I think, you know, Linton and Dean, and I think Big Bob scored just a series of goals pretty quickly. But there's very few games where with quarter of an hour, 20 minutes to go, you're so relaxed because you're so far ahead on the scoreboard. It was a unique game. But I think if you actually got to watch the first half and said it finishes 7-1, people would be like, no way, it looks like Crewe are going to get back into it. I think they had a couple of decent players who played at the time. But yeah, I don't remember the night out. It was a Saturday, there was a game, there was probably a night out that followed. That was pretty much what it was in those days.
Would it be like players bar and then straight out kind of thing?
Yeah, it probably not straight out, probably couple in the players bar, back home, showered and changed, and then meet somewhere and night around town. Biritz was always a favourite meeting place. And then, you know, I guess as you was younger, he was in places like Ritzy. And then as you got a little bit older, you'd move on to LA's. So that was where most of the lads used to go. You used to get a sportsman's pass for it, which sounds ridiculous now in the modern era. But there's been times when you've had away games. Terry used to get off at Ferriby. The lads would get the party gear on and suddenly the team bus would drop you off outside LA's, sportsman's pass, straight in and away you go. It was normal at the time. I guess you didn't know any different, but you sort of look now and you think, yeah, you've just been beat 3-0 away somewhere, and next thing the team bus is stopping outside LA's and lads are getting off and going straight in.
But you have a good relationship with the fans, obviously, when you see them out and stuff.
Yeah, there was never any bother. I think there was times where people were, they're having a bad, you know, the club were having a bad time, people would talk to you about it, but I never had any problems where you would literally go, I've been abused, or people have made comments or anything derogatory like that. I think people say, it's not great at the moment, is it? But not, I never felt any of it was personal. Most of it was directed at the state of the club and obviously lack of money, lack of signings and everything. And, you know, as a local lad, there was never any times when you thought, I'm not safe going out or anything. There was, you know, don't get me wrong, there was probably a couple of games where you thought, not necessarily. So when you go to Doncaster and get beat, you're not necessarily going to go out on the night. And I think the people were sensible like that, but it was never threatening or never unsafe. And more so the other, I think if you did have, you know, again, debut, we went out and that was how we're doing. But generally people were wanted to have a chat with you and it was all pleasant. And so there was, you know, the good outweighed the bad far, far more.
I think Hobbo said, you know, the fans, because you were Hull lads, that kind of look after you even more kind of thing, always, you know, want to look after you kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, as I said, there was never anything. And lads was, I think it was just like normal kids. If people stopped for a chat, everybody had a chat with people. Everybody was approachable. You know, everybody lived in normal houses, normal streets. It just felt a bit more connected.
Yeah, just going back to the players' bar, because I'm not mentioning that really much. Was it Don and his wife that used to run it?
Yeah, Don and his wife Gwen used to run it, and obviously David Mail was involved there. Yeah, it was. It was just somewhere where players of both teams would go and the families after the game. So it was all pretty. It was good fun, really. You never had more than, you know, more than a couple. And sometimes you were driving, you wouldn't have any. But it was a chance that after you'd got showered and changed after the games, you would go in there. Not enough for me. I'd see my mum and dad in there and have a chat with them about the game and other things like that. And they'd mix with the other. With the other parents, so yeah, it was quite a nice thing.
And then yeah, 95, 96, you're playing pretty regular in that side, but obviously it's a tough season. And then I've asked, you know, other players like, as local lads, how hard was it for you, kind of in that environment with the protests and stuff?
I never thought it was hard. There was always a bit of me that, you know, someone who's grown up a Hull City fan saying actually, if I wasn't playing, I'd have probably been protesting myself. That's how it was. Nobody wanted to see the club like that, least of all the players. And I think by that point, if I'm sort of right, that's a season where, you know, I think anybody who had been there as a sailor. So Linton would have gone, Graham Atkinson went, Hobbo went, Fetz went, Dino went. Anybody who a few seasons ago, you almost felt, or a couple of seasons ago, you felt with a little bit of an addition, we could have challenged. I remember, I think we had Ray Wallace, who came on loan, played right back, right midfield. And I think they only needed something like 25 grand to sign him, but couldn't sign him. And it was a real threadbare squad. And so you never really got to the playoffs where you felt you could have done. But around when you know, 95, 96, it felt like you were stripped back. And dare I say, if the players were honest, you would have looked around that dressing room and it was no surprise what happened that season. There wasn't necessary. You didn't have the right mix between young lads and experience. I think we had players there who were not necessarily capable of playing at that level, and so it almost became inevitable that they sank down into the bottom league.
Obviously, that Bradford game's got to be probably the strangest game you've played in, I imagine, especially as a whole lad with the switching of stands and everything.
Yeah, I mean, I was injured for that, so I didn't play. But it was, you know, and I've heard lots about the reasons for it, but it just felt wrong. The same reasons that were put forward, I guess, around the numbers of away fans travelling and everything. You could have had that virtually in, there's so many games before then and since then that would have happened, but the solution has never been, let's give the away fans the main home end in any game. It just seemed that, you know, and I think at the time it would have been driven by finances and making sure that as many people from Bradford who wanted to come and pay did. But at the time it felt wrong, and it's felt wrong ever since. And I think it was, you know, the main home end, and I know for myself, because I used to go in the South Stand and South Stand Seats as a kid, it just felt symbolic, and it just felt, no matter how bad things are, this was the final insult that not only are we struggling, not only are we going down, we've even given away our, from a tribal point of view, we've given away our end as well. I didn't think it was great.
Am I right in thinking you didn't play from like February 96 to December 96? Was that through injury?
Yeah, I think I had a few niggly hamstring injuries. And then, you know, I think at that time, obviously, I think Simon Trevitt was there, was playing ahead of me and was playing in the reserves, and sort of, yeah, it was a difficult time. He wasn't getting picked necessarily. And I think, you know, when Terry was there, I think there was Simon Trevitt, I think Jamie Marks, Kenny Gill. There was a number of right backs that we brought in who suddenly played ahead of me at that time at various stages. I think I had a little bit where I played a couple of games at left back or in midfield, and you ended up sort of getting switched about a little bit. I think there was one time we had a good run of games at right back. Someone got injured at left back, they moved me across. And then Simon came in at right back. And then when the left back's fit again, you're out the team. And so he was a little bit bitty like that for that period.
It settles down a bit in Division 3, like I think finished maybe mid-table or something. But are you, as players, are you gagging for a change in terms of management, or are you just kind of cracking on?
Yeah, I think everybody wanted a change and wanted it to freshen up. I think it's no secret, and everybody who said that, you know, Terry was okay. Jeff had some strange ideas. He was he wasn't necessarily the best person to play for. I think I coped with it, but I there'll be a lot of young lads who was in and around the club at that time who would generally say he ruined confidence and careers, and it wasn't necessarily the right environment to bring young players through in. I remember one game where we sort of trained at practice match at Costello, where I'm playing right back and I've rolled the ball into midfield. And he's literally stopped the full session. And I must be 18, 19. And his words to me was, when you get the ball at right back, it goes in behind the opposition left back. And if you don't like it, you can off and we'll bring someone else in who will. And you sort of think, you know, from a playing point of view, when you play at school and you love football, nobody's playing football to go, what do you love most about football? Oh, every time I get the ball, when I just have to whack it as far as I can behind the opposition. No, that's not necessarily for, people can do it and some people will play to that, but I just don't, for me, it's like, I'm not really sure this is, it's enjoyable or that. And that's how they played and that's how they wanted to play. And I think the thing with Jeff, he was full on, whether it was every training session, every game, there was, you know, his comments to people were abusive. And I think it ground a lot of people down and people's confidence was shot. So I think from that point of view, nobody was sorry to see them go.
When I was talking to Richard Peake, I didn't really ask him about the style of play, but it must have been frustrating for players like him and Money, I guess, at times.
Yeah. Because, you know, for me, my philosophy on right back is you play right back. The game's different now, but also my philosophy on right back virtually is you play right back because you're not quite good enough to play right midfield. And it's maybe not quite as simple as that. But I always felt my job as a right back was to give it to the kids who can play. So Rich Peacock ahead of me, when I get the ball, I want to give Rich the best possible service so he can go and get at the opposition left back, get crosses in and play to his game. And my instruction was not to do that. It was to get the ball at right back and put it in behind the opposition left back for our strikers to run into the hole. And that's basically how he wanted to play. So Rich and Manny, they were always ever feeding off scraps. You wasn't necessarily encouraged to play through midfield, which is ironic because you had one of the best playing surfaces across all the divisions. And yet we was playing a way that wasn't, I didn't think it was conducive to, you know, to the players we had as well. So you look at Manny and Rich, players who were decent technically, and you're trying to play a way where you're just going to smash the ball as far as you can, as early as you can.
Then obviously the Hatley comes in. Reading The Decade again recently, and I'm right in thinking you found out early on that you weren't going to be in his plans initially.
Yeah, again, I think I got a slight injury and I went on a pre-season trip to Scotland and I didn't go. And literally got called in his office. I think it was me. I can remember me and Paul Fewins, and might have been a couple of others. And it was basically everybody whose contract was up at the end of the season. And he basically said, "Your contract's up at the end of the season. We're not going to renew it." And that was that. I think, you know, when you look now, and even by his own admission, I've read some of the things he said. Is I think he was promised virtually he would be able to do what he wanted in terms of bringing people in. So he thought his first job was to get rid of as many people as he could. So he said, obviously, you know, the first, anyone who was out of contract, we want to get rid of them. And then I think he tried to make life difficult for the ones who were on contract. A good story about that, to be honest. It was, it makes me laugh anyway. Hatley and Billy Kirkwood, what they used to do was, as I said, he wanted everybody gone. He wanted to bring himself in, and he treated people like there was going to be gone in a month. And so that, I think, was the biggest downfall and mistake that he made, that the players who we didn't treat particularly well, he ended up needing them for the full season because of, you know, everything else. So we used to train at Hull University, obviously around the corner from us. And if you want in the first team squad, the first team squad had trained, so there'd be 16 of them. The juniors used to train. And there was maybe 8 or 9 of us left in limbo at that time. You want in the first team squad, you want in the junior squad. So you used to train on your own. And obviously what used to happen is Billy Kirkwood used to then say, finish training about 11:30, Billy would say, I want you back at Boothroyd Park at 2:30. And he used to have to do some running. Now, he only said 2:30. We could have ran at the university for fitness. We could have done whatever. It was designed to annoy the lads who were out of town. So like Simon Trevitt lived in Huddersfield. Mike Quigley lived in Manchester. It was basically to say at 11:30, you finish training and you've got to hang around for 3 hours till 2:30. We'll run you for 30 minutes. And then Friday afternoon traffic, you're not going to get back to Manchester till 5:30, 6:00. And I think it was deliberately done to almost get the players to think, I've had enough of this, I want the contract paying up, and to try and, or half your contract paying up, or to try and get rid of him. But what used to happen, he didn't realise, obviously I live around the corner, down Bremer, so it got to the stage where I'd say to my mum, can I bring the lads back and we'll just have a game of darts or something? So what was done to annoy him ended up with my mum putting cups of tea and bacon sandwiches on, and 8 or 9 of us having a darts tournament for a few hours in the afternoon before we went back. So it probably had the opposite effect to what he wanted in the end.
But you do end up playing like quite early on in that season. So what was that like? Was that a bit like, were you still motivated to play, obviously?
Yeah, do you know what I mean? It didn't make any difference because I think we sort of played, and then I don't know why, but he was playing with wing-backs, and he... Even in the reserves, I was sort of playing as one of the centre halves, and he'd almost played everybody at right back except. And I think we'd got however many games, and I'd not even played at right back. I was playing all over. But then I got, do you know what? And I got back in the team, and I got back in the team, and everything was fine. And I don't think even from any game I've ever played, I've always tried to play the same way, whether it was Haley, Jeff, any game I've ever played. I don't think necessarily how I've been treated has affected my thoughts going into a game or anything like that. But when you was in the team, I thought the training was decent, and it was varied, and it was okay. But you still couldn't get away from the way he treated you when he was in the first team was vastly different to when he was trying to just get them 8 or 9 players off there. And I came in, I think we played that year was a game where I think I played in the first leg against Palace at home. Had a few games, got it. But I think in the end that season, I think I scored twice and played 20-odd games and probably had a decent run, but nothing ever changed. So from the minute he came in pre-season and said, when your contract's finished, you're going to be released, all the time I was in the first team, all the time I thought I did all right, there was never a conversation that he had with me to say, I might be changing my mind, I might be doing anything. The season just finished and that was it.
And I read that you said he had an attitude a bit in training of like, you know, you hear about these ex-players that go to manage lower league.
Yeah.
That have the attitude of, you know, why can't you do what I was capable of kind of thing.
Yeah, I always felt like him with him. I think he gave an interview to the paper early on, and he was very much like, it was just stating the obvious, which was one of the things I have to get used to is realising the players I'm playing with are not as good as what I'm used to. And you sort of think, yeah, we're not, you know, you know that already. And I think that sort of, that attitude came across in lots of things he did. I think there was a run of games where he missed our games, and it was some, and I've said this before, I can't remember the exact run again, but it's something like, you know, Barnet, Exeter, Torquay, Mansfield, he missed. He was then miraculously fit for Franco Baresi's testimonial in Milan, and then he missed Rochdale and someone else and someone else. And he didn't quite feel that he was in it with you to that extent. And yeah, you know, some of the stories, bearing in mind, we was young lads, a lot of local lads, and anyone who, I know I had Richie, and he used to train with a mobile phone in his sock, and he did, and he trained with a mobile phone in his sock. Nobody had mobile phones in them days. It used to ring, he used to walk up. You'd be playing 8v8, and all of a sudden he'd walk off, and you're playing 8v7, and next thing he picks up his phone, he answers his phone, he comes back on, and he says, lads, Versace's dead. And it was when Versace got shot in Italy, and he got killed. But, you know, he's telling a group of lower league footballers, Versace's dead, and then he says, I was wearing his suits in Milan before he was famous. And, you know, I think one of the lads had almost said, well, let me know when Mr. CNA dies. And that's more, you know, that's more us local lads we had about one suit. And it was things like, there was just a bit of a disconnect. And I don't think he necessarily, I think with a bit more experience, he didn't realise necessarily the effect that he would have had on people.
Yeah, yeah. And then obviously playing himself in the bigger games when he never really got a run of form himself together. Must have been frustrating for the strikers.
Yeah, he said he had a lot of injuries. Niggly injuries came on, and then suddenly, you know, he's there for the big games. But by that point, he wasn't necessarily mobile or anything. You know, you can't dispute the levels he's played at. Was a fantastic player, and I think he's probably learnt a lot from from his experience at Hull. But it was no surprise, even after the season I left, which was what, the Great Escape season, it was no surprise to see them struggle there. And so throughout, they got worse and worse and worse. And even when Joycey took over, the first thing he did was bring big Gary Brabham and John Whitney, big names in terms of experience and dressing room atmosphere. And just I felt like that was the right thing to do, because the squad just ended up being a soulless place by the end of my time there.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that Palace at home game, because we've talked quite a bit about the away game, but you know, that home game is probably the biggest home game of the year in terms of the crowd and everything. And I remember it was always a thing back in the day. It was like, oh, you always get more time against Premier League opposition. Is that true or not?
I found whenever we played against the better, I think there was a couple of examples. One is I played Coventry in the League Cup as well. And so my experience with Coventry and Palace playing in League Cup games, I found the pace of the game to be far faster. So it was one of them. I didn't think it was, oh, this is easy. It just seemed the way the break and the quality was really, really quick. There was, they'd probably give you more room to play in. But yeah, I thought you could see when you step up how quick the thought was and the players were. It did seem a step up.
There's a story in the Decade you told about David Rowcastle, which was good. Did he kind of, he was apologising to you for making you come on or something?
Yeah. You know, it was an interesting, brilliant character. One of the few players you play with who you sort of, it gives you a real, not that you needed it, but a real understanding of why you play at the level you do and why they've played at the level they did. Looked, you know, absolute Rolls Royce, even at legs, knees going a little bit, everything. You could see his quality. And I generally didn't think anything of it. He'd got injured. He was struggling with his knees. Gaffer says to me, Adam, get warmed up. You're coming on. That's fine. Ball went out for a goal kick for us. He's come off. I've come on. Keeper's kicked the ball and the ball for full time. And obviously, shake hands. A few of the lads thought it was thought it was funny. He bothering getting a shower, all the usual stuff. But that was that. And then obviously on the Monday, he pulled me and he said, look, he said, I'm really sorry. If I'd have known how much time was left, I'd have stayed on. I didn't mean to disrespect you or anything like that. And then, you know, when you think, I genuinely hadn't thought about it. It was, if you need to go on, you need to go on. That's the nature of football. But I thought, for like an ex-England international to be concerned about me at 21, of, you know, he was apologising. He hadn't disrespected me as a local lad in front of a lot of people. I thought it was a real story that told everything about who he was, that he thought he cared that much.
Something in the Decade about Warren Joyce kind of batting for you in terms of your contract.
Yeah.
Is it frustrating for you? Well, I'll just explain, I suppose, that he said you deserved a new contract.
Yeah, well, I spoke to Warren just before the end of the season. I said I was in, I'd scored a couple of goals, was doing I thought was doing quite well in what was a side that was struggling. And Warren just said to me, he said, has Gaffer spoke to you? And I was like, no, he's not said anything. And I said, and Warren to me always said, I can't see him releasing you while you're playing like this. He must surely offer you something else to stay at the club. But he didn't, and that was that. And then obviously, I think, you know, by the time Warren takes over, you're so far into the next season, things are different. And probably, you know, I look at it was, I wouldn't have been ready to go back, in the sense of I had a tough 6 months. I had a tough, you know, and I've heard a lot of people talk around how good it is to play for your local club and how good it is to make your debut for the team you support as a boy. And all of that's great, but you'll never hear anybody, probably for obvious reasons, how hard it is to get rejected from the club that you've supported all your life, and what a difficult time it is to transition into whatever you do. And I'm a big believer that there does need to be more done for players, because, you know, I look back now and think, I had a really difficult 6 months to readjust to life outside of the game. You're not only losing the club that you've supported and that you've played for, you lose almost your entire friendship group as well. So sort of like, you know, Manny, Greavesy, Rich Peak, all the lads who you've been mates with a number of years, they're still there connected to the club. You've been removed from that, and it's really tough to rebuild.
Yeah, I can imagine. It must be like, you know, your identity at that time is being a City player, isn't it? And that's taken away, kind of thing.
Yeah, and it is. You know, you lose your identity, you lose your friendships. You probably become a little bit, you know, it's like anything with rejection. So that year for the Great Escape, you know, you don't want the team to thrive without it. You want the team to struggle, and you sort of get consumed by looking at the results. I'm glad they got beat, but then you've got sort of mixed emotions, because you've got some really good mates there. And I think for me, what I needed was obviously when Mark left and Warren took over, I liked Warren. You've got your friends there, and that was probably the time where he was able to almost support the club. Again, it was the different people were there to the ones who had kicked you out. And that was, I think, the first step towards that. I mean, played at Gainsborough at the time was absolutely rubbish. There was so much going on. I signed for Ferriby. And I think Ferriby as well, I think because I'm a local lad, Ferriby felt like it was mine as well, in the same way that Hull City did. It felt like it was my area. I felt like I represented them. And that's where you start to get a bit of your love back. But it was a tough 6 months.
In your last season, you know, you managed to score a screamer against, I think it was Leighton Orient. And in the decade, you said that was your high point, really, of playing for City. Is that right?
Yeah, your debut was something, as I said before, your debut is that point where nobody ever takes that away from you. You are a Hull City player, and whatever you do, whether you don't play ever again or whether you play City, you can always call yourself a Hull City player. So your debut was special. But I think for me, scoring at the South Stand, where you used to stand and sit as a kid and support, I think that's something, again, that you look back on. And it would have been tinged with a little bit of regret if I'd not managed to do that. You only score 3 goals, you're never going to be prolific. So there was a bit of probably luck involved. But the proudest moment is scoring there and being able to celebrate in front of the place where you've been since you was a young kid and seen some of the great games, you know, the Liverpool games, as where you went as a kid and seen that. So yeah, that was definitely a high point for me.
Yeah, and it's a bonus that it comes in a winning performance as well, which were a bit sparse that season.
It was quite a good game. I think it said there was a lot of games that were probably instantly forgettable. I think Stephen Boyack scored a great goal in the same game, and it was an action-packed game. So yeah, it was nice to win and score.
And then while you're playing for Ferriby, I'm right in thinking you kind of had a real like direction in terms of what you wanted to do. You were going to uni and everything and getting a degree.
Yeah, do you know, it's different. I'd always felt academically that you finish school, you do your GCSEs and you do sort of a BTEC course. We used to do the course with all the other YTS lads. So I was in a class with the YTS lads from Leeds, Barnsley, York and all Bradford and all Rotherham and all the other lads. So you got to know some of the kids you played against who went on. You know, Paul Hurst, who manager and player, he was in my class at college, as was Graham Murty, who had a good career as well. So you got to know them lads at college. And I always felt academically I could do something. And so when I got released at City, I went back to university in York and did like a business and sports management degree combined. But it was still football that opened the doors. And I know you've asked a few people about people they remember at the times at City. And one of them, for me, John Davis, who just had started up with the football in the community. When I was a player, I started to do some, speaking at school assemblies and do the other things that's great that players do within the community. And it was when I got released, said it's a tough period. I knew I wanted to go to university, but other than that, you know, it is a difficult time. And John said, if you fancy doing any coaching, just let me know and we can go and get you sorted within the community scheme. So I did. It worked out well that whilst I was at university, holidays, you'd do the coaching. And it got me involved with the Centre of Excellence as well, which was great and probably opened up a lot of doors to career-wise what I'm doing now. At that point, you didn't get paid for it. You just went. But the opportunity to work with some young players was great. And, you know, I can look back now at the kids who I coached during the Centre of Excellence time, sort of Will Atkinson, Nicky Featherston, even Russ Fry, Scott Wiseman, and then Liam Cooper, Connor Townsend, kids who've gone on and played, you know, league football. It's great to have been a small part of their journey as 11-year-olds, 14-year-olds, whatever it was. So I still had that connection to the club coaching there, which I really enjoyed as well.
And I'm reading here that you played for England at futsal, is that right?
I did manage it, yeah. I sort of stopped playing. I got to a stage at Ferriby and it was difficult because I was coaching at Hull City Centre of Excellence probably, I think it was Wednesdays and Fridays, and the games was on a Sunday. Ferriby were Tuesday, Thursday and Saturday, and suddenly you're out every night of the week and it was all consuming and something had to give. And the thing for me, the coaching and the career was going upwards and the playing was going downwards. So it was a decision that I felt was the right one to make for me at that time. Didn't play for a few years. And then we started, got involved with a little bit of futsal and started playing some futsal and entered a national tournament. And we entered a national tournament. I think we got into the plate competition. We won the plate competition. I think the main competition, we had a few players who were still at work, couldn't play. So we missed out on that. But we won the plate. And then I got invited for England trials, which was, I think I was about 32 at the time. But you know, a letter comes through saying you've got England trials. It's like, what's this? This is a bit odd. So Went to these trials. I think it was might have been Hinckley or somewhere down south at a university where you went and played. And then next thing, a letter came through the door saying you've been selected to play for England. And it was a tour in, went to 5 days in France and played Holland and France at futsal. It was absolutely brilliant. National anthem, you know, again, something no one can ever take away from you. But I had to have 5 days off work to actually go and do it. Annual leave, and then I had a young family at the time, and so when you think about it, you thought, I've done it now, but I can't do this again. I can't use my annual leave with a young family going and playing in different places. So I sort of one tour and retired again. But yeah, it was quite a bizarre story. To I ended up singing the national anthem in a place in France.
How did it go on? And like, who were you playing?
We played Holland and France, and I think at that time England futsal was almost emerging, and there was established teams, and I think we lost both games, and I think the French, I think a lot of them play it quite regularly. I think we lost sort of 7 or 8, 2 or 3 in both games, I think. But it was good experience. And they, at that point, they had quite a few fans in. It was quite a big thing for them.
I'm like semi-familiar with it. Is it like a smaller, heavier ball with like less players?
Yeah, smaller, heavier. I think it's all, in a lot of countries, it doubles up as a where they have handball courts. So they play handball and futsal. So whereas we would play traditional five-a-side indoor, off the bounce boards and those things, they don't play that in a lot of other areas. South American concept, obviously, from where it is. But yeah, when you watch the quality of them, it is a really good game. And it's a good game in its own right, but it's also a really good game as a development tool to make players better players.
Are you still working for the East Riding County FA? Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah. So still involved, obviously, in local football. Again, I look back on my professional days where you're just really lucky to meet some outstanding people, and the sense of camaraderie that team sport gives you at whatever level. And I genuinely don't think, I don't think the level matters. So when we work within grassroots sport now, there'll be people who've played grassroots sports. They'll have the same stories that I've got. The games will be slightly different, but it's all about the people to meet, the nights out they've had, their experiences. And I think that just comes with being part of a team, and there's some fantastic people who give up an awful lot of time for nothing to support the grassroots game. And it's a real pleasure. It comes with some challenges, obviously, like everything else, but it is a real pleasure to be involved in it.
And also reading, I didn't realise, but apparently you're a prominent voice in the campaign against the name change to Hull Tigers. Is that right?
Prominent voice. We was involved. We was one of the people who were statutory consultees from the FA. So the FA asked us what our opinion was on the strength of local feeling. So that's basically what we had to feed back to the FA. So we had how we did it. Like, the county FA is made up obviously of staff members, but it's also made up of a council, which at the time was volunteers from within local leagues, and we'd task leagues to go back and speak to their committees and try and get a sense of perspective of, which was very difficult to get some balance at the time, because feelings were strong about what the general thoughts were. And then at the time, our view of what came back was people was against it, and that was the representation we made back to the FA, that we felt people were against it. So yeah, we was asked, and obviously the letter carried my name at the bottom, but I also knew at that point there was a risk. If it had gone the other way, the other letter would have carried my name at the bottom as well, which I, from a personal point of view, I was nervous about, because I could sort of sense that the feeling, and I didn't want, given everything I'd done for the club, being involved with the club, I didn't want my name at the bottom of a letter that says the county FA support the name change and we give it our full blessing. I think it would have been difficult for me personally, but it wasn't. And yeah, and obviously the rest was went as it was. I remember getting the information. It was quite strange. We had, you know, John Suddard as our representative was in the council meeting when it was voted on. I think we had calls from Sky Sports asking if we knew what was happening, and we got the message and I knew what the verdict was, and then obviously went to appeals and everything. But I think more than anything, I think it's that bit, which is a big thing now, and hopefully the new owners, that bit around fan engagement. Fan engagement is really important, and I'd seen they're starting to meet the fans groups, and you know, I agree with what everybody says about owners and chairs being custodians for a limited period of time. Fans, it's generational. It is their club, and you know, I think regulatory, there has to be more more emphasis on people being able to only act within certain constraints and fans having a bigger say on what happens within the clubs.
Who was the toughest opponent you faced at Boothby Park, or just generally at your time at City, do you think?
Yeah, I think those. Well, I think for me, one of the ones I'm sort of most proud of was with playing a right back, you're always marking the left winger. And when we drew Coventry in the League Cup, I played against John Salako twice, who had been an England international, and he was quick and pacey, and two reasonable games against him. But yeah, to know you're going to line up against someone who's been picked for the country was a really a good thing for me.
Any standout memories or anything you do differently?
I'm not sure they do different. People used to say, "I bet you'd love to have played at the stadium," or "I bet you'd love to be there now" and things. But I'm always quite philosophical, because there is a chance that if I'd have played for the club at a different era, when they had maybe more resources, I might not even played for the first team. So you might have been one of them players, and like there's a lot of whoever the Brian Mitchell was of a different area, whenever he got injured, they would have brought someone else in. And as a young lad, I would never have even got that chance. So I don't necessarily sort of think, I wish I'd have played. Everything's different. Everything moves on. I have very few regrets about anything at all. And, always look back with a huge sense of pride that he did it. It was me, proud to meet some outstanding individuals. And we all meet up now, I think we're, as I said, probably as a result of this, where I've listened to, I'm not just saying that because I'm on it, where I've listened to a couple, and then you've messaged a couple of lads who said, it'd be great for us to get out, and then we're going to go have a night in Sheffield on the 25th of March, something like that. But the best one is, it's like the same night out, and you just repeat it every 5 years. So the only things you talk about are what happened 20 odd years ago now. It just keeps getting, wife will say to me, "Oh, Scott's wife, how are his kids getting?" I said, "No idea. All we do is talk about Jeff, Hatley, the memories, Hull City," and it just, the same stories just repeat themselves, but we'll have a great time.
And then just last one, I put on Twitter that you're coming on, and we got a couple of interesting replies. One from someone called John saying, "Can you ask him when he's going to turn the heating up in the office?"
Chris works with it. The heating's at a good level, but obviously bills are going up. You've got to be careful. But yeah, Chris does a good job for us. He looks after our a lot of it, like the male pathway, so encouraging more male teams, whether that's youth football, adult football, veterans. So yeah, he's doing a cracking job for us.
And then Gary Hobson just replied saying, "How long is his back?"
Well, story was, Manny, for whatever reason, decided that I had real short legs and a long back, which was hence the nickname Long Back, imaginatively. So there's Hobbo's question about having a long back.
Well, that's a hell of a finishing point, but I guess we'll leave it there.
Yeah. that was like the nicknames from those days. Cracking. You'll never catch that tiger.
Thanks for listening to this episode of This Was Boothry Park. As always, just like to give a quick shout out to those who made the research easy, including OnCloud7, TigerTube Player, Tiger Bass, and Rich Gardens The Decade.